Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more.
Welcome to Jazz on the Tube. Today we're talking with somebody we're really happy to be talking with because he's interested in the same thing that we're interested in, which is longtime listeners to Jazz on the Tube know we love New York. I'm from New York City. I respect the New York jazz scene. I've spent a lot of years cumulatively in New Orleans. I totally respect the New Orleans jazz scene. However, there are other cities in America that contributed to the formation of jazz and birthed many, 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 many great musicians. And I think, and I got this insight initially from Douglas Henry Daniels, the great professor from the University of California, one of the state universities in the university system. And he really opened my eyes by pointing out what an amazing jazz center Oklahoma City was. And for a New Yorker, that just seems impossible. How could that be? But when you dig into it, you find out, jazz came from everywhere. And our guest today is an expert on a lot of things, but he's especially expert on the contributions that Boston has made to the jazz scene. And we're very happy to have him. I'd like to welcome Richard Vaca. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Ken. Delighted to be here, and thanks for the invitation.
And Richard is the author of the book, The Boston Jazz Chronicles. He also has a super blog called TroyStreet.com. Great writing, really interesting stories, and if you want to get deep into a lot of things, in particular the Boston's jazz history, this is absolutely the place to go and do that. So where to begin? Let's start maybe for people who have not been to Boston, or maybe they live around Boston. Maybe they're an international and they're thinking of making a trip to the States. Let's talk about the current Boston jazz scene. So if somebody wants to come to an American city and they decide that Boston's going to be on their itinerary, how would they go about accessing the great jazz of Boston?
If you want to go hear jazz in Boston now, there are two different approaches to take. The thing that Boston does, and historically has always done better than anybody else in the country, is education. We'll just out-educate anybody. So when it comes to music education, we have Berklee and we have the New England Conservatory, both of which have thriving jazz programs, and both of which offer all kinds of concerts by, students, by staff, by faculty. And there is always, during the school year, something doing in those places, in their own concert halls and recital halls. And it happens to be cheap, too. So it's a good way to hear a lot of music. You might not know the people, but the music will be excellent. And then there is the full battery of clubs. There's about 10 or 12 that have jazz regularly. Now, I won't specifically call them jazz clubs. They're music clubs. But jazz is on the schedule quite a bit in some cases. There are two that book nationally known name bands, the Regatta Bar in Cambridge and Scholars Jazz Club in the Alston neighborhood in Boston. But then there are many more that have, the local guys and whatnot. The Top of the Prue is one place in the Prudential Center. Down in the South End, there's numerous places. Daryl's Corner Bar, a club called the Beehive, and of course the granddaddy of them all is Wally's, which has been continuously operating as a jazz club since January 1st, 1947. I'll say that again, January 1st, 1947. They got started as a jazz club, and it's still run by the same family.
That's got to be one of the older jazz clubs in the world. Still running. Second. Who's
the
first?
Only one? Vanguard.
Oh, the Vanguard. Okay. Wow. Okay.
Uh-huh. That's it. That's the only one that's older. So this is in the same family and still chugging along jazz 365 days a year. So if you really needed a fix on Christmas, you could go there and they would have music for you. There are also places up in Cambridge, and the places up in Cambridge, aside from the Regatta Bar, which is in a hotel, these places tend to be pushing the music a little toward the outside more. The Lily Pad, the Outpost 186, another place down in Central Square called Mad Monkfish. So you can, if you're of a mind to hear some jazz between the schools and between this battery of clubs, you'll find something to listen to.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Wow. I had no idea. And I'm sorry to say that my poor research, we were only there a couple of days, did not yield much information about jazz in Boston. Did go to the exhibit, which is where I found your book, which is at the African American?
Museum of African American History, yes.
Which currently, and when I say currently, it's we're at the very last day of 2019 going into 2020. There's a great exhibit on the Boston jazz scene, also a beautiful photography exhibit. All right, so we've talked about the contemporary scene, and boy, that tip about Berkeley and the New England Conservatory is great because I bet there's some amazing stuff going on there.
You can't beat it, really. Almost every night of the week, there's something interesting to listen to. And at the New England Conservatory, sometimes you'll wander into classical music as well, you know, because that's really what its long suit is. That's really what it's known for. But the Boston University has great music school, and there's music there. Northeastern has some music, and you know, even MIT has a really good concert band. So
really?
It's all over the and Harvard's jazz orchestra is terrific, has been for years. So that's what we do here in Boston. We'll just out educate anybody, and if your thing is music, we're going to out educate you in music and give you opportunities to play.
Wow! So Boston is not just
you got to come back, man.
I'm already planning. So Boston's not just a place with some jazz. Boston's a place with a ton of jazz.
Well, I think so. Yeah. The fact that it's not name band jazz, you know, some people will say, well, you don't have all that much jazz, you know, but it's not true. There's just a lot of local scene here.
Gotcha. And then, of course, Boston has the perennial problem of being, you know, a couple of hours away from the Big Apple, you know. So I guess by point of comparison, people will say, well, you're not New York, you know, but who is? Who's got that?
But that closeness to New York has actually been one of Boston's strongest suits over the years. There is another writer who has done some work in this area. He's fond of calling it the Boston-New York pipeline. Many, many musicians have come from Boston and gone to New York. You know, this is like, if you're a baseball fan, this is like a AAA team in some respects, in that this is where people learn, and then they go off to New York to try to make it, you know, in the big city. But many musicians have jumped on the train and gone down from Boston to New York City over the years. Some have come back the other way. And now with Berkeley and the New England Conservatory being, you know, so prominent, there's a lot of teaching jobs here. And there's a lot of people on the faculties of these schools who are living in two communities. They're working here part of the week, and they're back in New York City part of the week.
Oh, interesting.
So and over time, that has been a good thing to be this close to New York. Do we start, you know, how do we want to talk about the Boston jazz scene and how it developed?
Well, let's
proximity to New York really is an important piece of that.
Oh, sure. Well, let me ask this question, though, before we get to that. Because I don't know the answer to this. Who are some of the greats that came out of Boston, maybe native sons? Does Boston have a roster of people that, you know, came from the Boston area?
How much time have we got?
Oh, okay. And by the way,
if we go back way back to the start, you want just people who were born in this region, or do you want people who? Never mind. We can start with the Ellington Band, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney, Paul Consalvis, Jimmy Woody, who played bass with him for 5 years in the 50s. Lloyd Trotman, who played bass in the late 40s, took Pettiford's place. There have been several. Chuck Connors, the bass trombonist. All those guys were Boston guys. if you're looking for some of the other ones, the thing that I'm really interested in the most is the modern jazz scene. And the swing scene was nice. You know, Charlie Holmes and Swan Johnson and Kaiser Marshall and Benny Waters, all those guys were Bostonians. But it's the modern jazz guys that are really surprising. That Jackie Byard was here, Charlie Mariano, Herb Pomeroy. There's quite a few names that will... Joe Gordon was a townie. Lenny Johnson, Dick Twardzik. There are quite a few people have come from here. And starting in the 50s, they could actually start staying here and making a living, which is a big deal. That's, you know, that's when you get to have a jazz scene, is when there's enough work to keep people home.
Gotcha. So let's go back to the roots of jazz, the early years, which I would say are the 20s, maybe even the late teens, you know. What was Boston's role in that formative period?
Boston's African-American community was quite small, especially as a percentage. It was only about 3% of the city's population. And if you and this is, you know, in the period between the wars. And if you look at Chicago or Cleveland or Detroit, they have much, much larger African-American populations. And so the pool of musicians in those cities was much bigger. So there was jazz in Boston, as you say, going back to the teens. But the scene was pretty small. And it just sort of chugged along. And there were some good musicians here, but mostly they're like Johnny Hodges and Harry Carney. They went to New York to seek their fame and fortune. But people were already coming here to go to school in the 20s because the conservatories had a colorblind admission policy. So there were always people coming here. The big change happens with World War II. That's when all of a sudden, you know, Boston starts becoming something. And the reason for that is Boston is a port town. And the War Department chose Boston as a major point of embarkation for the European theater. And so the city was full of soldiers and sailors all the time during the war. And plus, they're shipping supplies out of here. So Boston's port was really busy. And all those soldiers and all those sailors needed fun at night. And there was work here in the clubs, a lot of work. And a lot of guys were coming up from New York. Frankie Newton lived here for 18 months. Vic Dickinson was here for almost that long. Buck Clayton was here for a while. There were quite a few good musicians from New York that just came here because there was so much work. And what that does is it raised the professionalism of the entire scene. Just by hanging around with these guys, learning from them, playing with them night after night, the Boston musicians started becoming quite good. One guy who came out of Boston with his own little big band, call it that, he was usually about an octet or so, was a guy named Sabby Lewis, who was a fairly well-known guy in the 1940s, both in Boston, where he was from, and New York City. He spent a lot of time there in the 40s, especially the late 40s. So that is really what starts Boston, you know, becoming more jazz aware. And then the war ends, and all of these soldiers and sailors were eligible for their GI Bill tuition money. And everybody who wanted to do music starts coming to Boston because there are these schools, and, you know, the African-American students don't have problems getting admitted. A man named Larry Burke started a school called the Schillinger House in 1945. A few years later, he changed the name of it to Berkeley, which is the name we know it by. So there were these schools, the Boston Conservatory, the New England Conservatory, Berkeley, Boston University. There are all these places where if you were interested in studying music, you could come here to do it. All these people who have their GI Bill money, they're all young, and they are interested in newfangled stuff that they were playing in the New York City and the Harlem clubs. They were interested in the early years of bebop. They wanted to play like Dizzy Gillespie. They didn't want to play like the swing guys. They certainly didn't want to play like the trad guys. So they were interested in modern jazz. So you have these people coming to Boston, you know, the Sam Riverses of the world are coming here, and Gigi Grice. And so they're coming here to go to school. And they're colliding with the people who were here, living here, playing here, working here. Joe Gordon was a Boston guy. Charlie Mariano was a Boston guy. Nat Pierce was a Boston guy. So you get this student group, and you have the townie group, and they are all pretty much of the same age and of the same outlook in terms of music, and it was sort of like the Boston Jazz Big Bang. Boom, all of a sudden there's a scene.
Huh.
And yeah, the schools were very important then, and they are much more important now, because I was listening to your interview with Bill Crow.
And
Bill Crow was, and you and Bill Crow were talking about how the way you learn jazz has changed over the years. From, you used to ride on the band bus and just learn by the apprentice system, but now educational institutions have a bigger and bigger role.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is, and Boston is truly a case in point there, that really the, now the academic institutions are really where it's at. But at this time, in around the late 40s and the early 50s, the two scenes were side by side, of the local apprentice type and the academic, we're trying to learn this in school types. And it was quite something. There was quite a lot of activity. The activity, you had mentioned something about, was there a peak when mm-hmm. you're trading emails?
And your golden age.
So this golden age, we're sliding into it here. And I think that you hit a point where by about January 1953, the musical scene here was just exploding on all fronts. And it wasn't simply jazz, because it's, you know, jazz is jazz, and it's, there are always things that are attracting people more. But you could have Duke Ellington working in Storyville, and Frank Sinatra working at the Latin Quarter, and Coleman Hawkins working at the hi-hat, and you could have all these things happening on the same night. And that kind of entertainment, and if one of those clubs is doing well, it tends to make all of them do well. And the nights, and the nightlife scene in Boston in 53, 54, 55 really boomed. If you're just trying to think about the jazz, there were probably about 10 jazz clubs, not clubs that have jazz sometimes, but jazz clubs working in the city. And we're not even in the burbs yet, just working in the city. And there were some in the white neighborhood, some in the black neighborhood. So that was really the big time. And all those people, Jackie Byard and Charlie Mariano, who I think those two are probably the most important people to come out of Boston at that time. Herb Pomeroy, Ray Santisi, you know, it was just a long line of people who went on to long and illustrious careers.
You know, it's something that as you're talking, that I realize if we count all the musicians that got educated in Boston, now we're talking about an amazing long list.
Yeah, it's hysterical when you try to, you know, there's nobody who's really ever been able to compile that list, because it's so long. And, you know, I don't have, you know, my own copy of the list that I've tried to build in front of me, but it does go everywhere, and it does touch everything. And just of people myself have interviewed who spent a lot of time here, you know, people like John Abercrombie, who had an amazing time here, and then you work here for a while, and then you get out of school and you stay here because you're working here, and then you move on. There are just so many musicians of that type.
I'm just thinking of Pat Metheny, you know, who's
Metheny was one of the guitar gang here.
Okay.
You know, I think, you know, Abercrombie was kind of the ringleader there, but, you know, Matheny was here, and Bill Frisell was here, and Mike Stern was here, and John Scofield was here, and they were all here at the same time, and Al Dimiola.
Oh, my God.
They were all here at the same time.
Oh,
all
my
here
goodness.
At the same time. So you could go to a place like Michael's, which was a pub down on just off Huntington Avenue, and you would find any of those guys playing on a particular night. You know, they were just that was were the guitar players.
You
know?
Wow.
It was, so that happens here. You know, some years are better than others, but at one point that was the clutch of guitar players that we had here.
That would have been the 70s, right? Or mid-70s?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Mid-early. And then we have a good friend who we talk with a lot, because he's such an expert on Afro-Cuban jazz, which is Bobby Sanabria, who's a major educator here in New York, band leader, big band leader, carrier of the torch, you know, for the Afro-Cuban tradition. But he got his formal education in music at Berkeley.
Yes.
So it's probably a very, very, very long list. You know, in New England Conservatory of Music, it sounds like a very staid, classical place, but of course they had Günter Schuller, right, teaching there?
Günter Schuller. Gunther Schuller took over the presidency there, I think it was in 1969. Okay. And during World War II, they had had a popular jazz, they had had a popular music program, but they let it die out. And Schuller came along and reinstituted it and had Carl Atkins and Jackie Byard as his chief lieutenants. And, you know, Phil Wilson was there for a while, and a lot of people were there and still are. You know, Jason Moran is teaching there now, and various others, Dominique Eid. And so Gunther Schuller really revolutionized the school, and he turned it. You know, they still have their nice, staid, conservative, whatever, classical departments. They're still going strong. But he did institute, you know, a jazz studies program, and he was also instrumental in bringing the school closer to the community. You know, there were a lot more involvement in community affairs and having the community involved in school affairs. That was a bit, you know, those were the activist years, and the NEC was definitely a part of that.
And then Berkeley, as you mentioned, started in the post-war era?
Berkeley started 1945, I think, is when Larry Burke started his school, and I think, you know, with about five students or something like that. And slowly but surely, he started hiring faculty and getting more students. He bought a building on Newbury Street. And from there, the school started to grow. I mean, it went from, I don't even know what the current enrollment is, but they would cross these milestones. Now we have 200 students. Now we have 400 students. Now we have 600 students. And it went from being a certificate-only school to an accredited college. And Larry Burke had a method. And he was very astute when it came to seeing places where musicians could work new opportunities. So he had a television scoring program in about 1952, before anybody really thought about making that formal. He was doing, right now, if you start looking at the credits for the people who are doing movie soundtracks, there are Berkeley people, a lot of them. But there were people working in television for years, and still are. Whenever something new was coming along, when electronic music started to happen, he started a program in it. So that has been the Berkeley way, that they keep their eye on the scene, and when something looks like it's going to develop into an academic pursuit, they're the ones pursuing it, you know, and that has been their modus operandi since the very beginning. Burke was an amazing guy.
He must have been, because this is, you know, Berkeley is one of the ultimate destinations for people that want to break into professional music as a jazz musician.
And it isn't even, it's not fair to even really call it a jazz school anymore. Yes, they still have a big jazz component. Once upon a time, you know, in the 50s and in the 60s, it was a jazz school. That was really what they were doing. And they had all those people like, you know, John LaPorta and Phil Wilson and Herb Pomeroy, Jack Peterson, all these guys were teaching it. But now there are so many different departments. I believe, I don't know, it trades back and forth. It's either the guitar major or the vocal major is the biggest one in the school right now. And these people aren't necessarily going to go off and play jazz. They're going to go off and play just about anything. And they do. So there's a long list of people who came from Berkeley who have nothing to do with jazz.
Okay.
There's one funny story. Well, Bruce Hornsby, we studied with a jazz pianist named Dean Earle, who was teaching, and if you weren't going to play jazz, Dean Earle wasn't really interested in you. So Hornsby comes back to school, you know, like 20 years later, the conquering hero or something like that, and he runs into Dean Earle in the hall, and Dean says, "So, are you still playing?" It was, you know, that kind of, you know, so it's that kind of thing that there were people doing, going into all kinds of pursuits and on all kinds of fronts, but they're all coming out of Berkeley. And it's an old boy network there. I mean, it really is an amazing place.
Let me throw you what might be a curve. I know that the roots of Berkeley was a guy named Joseph Schillinger. Is that how you say his name?
That's correct.
Yeah. And I first heard his name from Eddie Palmieri. And, you know, Eddie's the great Afro-Cuban jazz, you know, pianist, still going strong. In fact, he's playing this week, not far from here. And he raves about what Schillinger's theory did for him to help him understand. Because he knew the Afro-Cuban rhythms because he grew up with them. But there was some sort of a theoretical framework that Schillinger provided that just helped him. I'm not sure exactly how it helped him, but he talked so strongly about Schillinger. And then here's another example. Lawrence Burke getting inspired, clearly, because he was a student of Schillinger's, and I guess
Burke was one of the first nine to be accredited by Schillinger himself as being smart enough to teach the method. Hmm. It's not simple. It's heavy math. I mean, it's mathematical composition. And you can use the math to figure out to resolve your composition, you know, situations. It's a really complex thing. It's not as popular now as it once was. But when Schillinger was teaching Burke the method, some mm-hmm. of the other students, you know, George Gershwin was one of his students. Glenn Miller was one of his students. So there were people who were really trying to pay attention to it because they really thought he had something going on. And so Schillinger, it was called Schillinger House until 1954, and that's when the name changed to Berkeley. And the reason why the name changed is because they were interested in so many other things that it was no longer fair to really call the school Schillinger House. That was just it was just a piece of it.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, Burke, fascinating guy. He was an MIT engineer, MIT-trained engineer, and yep. somehow, I guess he was in New York City. That's where he hooked up with Schillinger, I guess, and then brought that back to Boston. Just a little side note of history. This Schillinger guy sounds like he was fascinating in his own right. Wow. So this is completely revolutionizing my view of Boston, and I hope for our listeners too. It's clearly an educational hub for music, and so you get the benefit of all those great students coming through, and then you have the local scene, and then you have the mixing and matching of you know, school musicians with some of the local musicians. You have a great infrastructure of clubs. It sounds like there's no shortage of venues. Can you tell us a little bit about your book if somebody were to get it? It's called The Boston Jazz Chronicles. What's that book about? How did you put it together?
The hard way. The book, the subtitle of that book is Faces and Places and Nightlife from 1937 to 1962. You can't do justice to a city jazz scene by trying to do the whole thing in one book. I think so. I just picked a 25-year period, and I started when the effects of the Prohibition were done. I think the clubs started opening up again in about 1935, legitimate clubs as opposed to speakeasies. Mm-hmm. And that's about the time I started my story. A lot of what I mentioned a little while ago about how the scene grew up during the war and came of age after it, I didn't know any of that. You know, this was all a big process of discovery for me. I was a geek. You know, I was in the software business.
Oh.
And I just sort of picked this stuff up because I'm a jazz fan and a jazz listener, and I was attending a lecture or a panel discussion in 2004, and it was a panel discussion where four or five of the old timers were sitting around just sort of reminiscing, and the crowd got very excited, and people are shouting out names, place names, people names, and everybody's getting into it. And the moderator, Eric Jackson, who is still on the radio here, Eric Jackson throws up his hands at one point, and he just says, "I sure hope somebody out there is writing all this down." And I said to myself, "I'll do it." And that's how I got started.
Okay.
And so I interviewed about 75 people to write that book, some of them very long, multi-session interviews, and some of them short, like this, telephone calls. But there were 75 people, and I went to the library nights and weekends and read microfilm, because I had to read the newspapers. People do take the easy way out. You know, the internet has given people the easy way out, that they think if they can find it online, that's all there is, and they don't want to do the hard work of, you know, turning the pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and turned the pages, and that's why there's all that detail in there, because I just went and dug it out. And I was able to build, you know, the picture of the Boston jazz scene over a 25-year period by reading the media. I read a newspaper a day for 25 years. And did all these interviews and accumulated a lot of music and ephemera and whatnot. So that was pretty good. Now I'm in the middle of Volume 2, which goes from 63 to 88, and that'll about do it. I think then I'll be exhausted.
Just for anybody who hasn't written a book, it's got to be the hardest work known to man that doesn't involve a shovel.
It is not as easy as one would like sometimes. This, you know, writing the next 25-year story is going to be very different. You know, on the one hand, many more witnesses are still around to talk to.
that's a good thing, but it's also, you know, a bad thing that there's so many witnesses around to talk to, because everybody's got their points of view, and sometimes they're pretty emphatic about them, and so that's, so it's going to be fun working all that out. Whole different club scene, whole different, you know, the scene changes completely several times over, and if you think about this in terms of a 50-year span of both books, I'm seeing whole cadres of whole cohorts of musicians starting out and developing and hitting a peak and plateauing and starting to decline. Whole cohorts of musicians going through that life cycle. And it's absolutely fascinating. And you've got, you know, the old band in Boston kind of thing with fighting off the censors and the alcohol control board. And, you know, there's as much Boston in these books as there is jazz music. So it's very interesting to learn this and go talk to the people and do the research. It's been fascinating.
You know, there's two big names out of Boston, not musicians, but people you can't imagine jazz without. One is Nat Hentoff, and, you know, I'm familiar with him. Well, I think a lot of people are, but he used to write for the Village Voice in New York, so I'd see his name all the time. And then, of course, the great George Wein, who people know as the organizer of Newport Jazz Festival, but he also ran a club in Boston that people may not be aware of if they're not Bostonians or Boston savvy.
Ran two clubs, actually. One was in the basement called Mahogany Hall. He ran the Storyville Club, and that was the nightclub in Boston. He ran that until 1960 when he got out of the nightclub business and to concentrate solely on the festival and concert business. And that's when he moved to New York. That's when he left Boston for New York.
But his first big festival project was Newport, right? Probably?
There were local festivals. He was involved with the Boston Festival of the Arts a little earlier than that, but that was basically putting on concerts at festivals. That wasn't really organizing a festival. So yes, you are correct. His first project was the 1954 Newport Jazz Festival.
Okay, so that, and I don't know, but I don't think there were many jazz festivals in 1954. I mean, now there's, gratefully, there's jazz festivals everywhere now. I think it's a great development.
Well, I think that, you know, that was the first real jazz festival in North America. You know, I mean, there were some jazz festivals in France in the late 40s, I think in Nice. But I think that prior to Newport in 1954, there weren't jazz festivals. There were festivals in the classical realm and places like Ravinia and Will's Trap and so forth, but there weren't jazz festivals. And George was the guy that really got that whole thing rolling. And then he went from Newport to, he started festivals in other places. And then it just rolled. And even after they kicked him out of Newport, that didn't slow him down.
I think he also helped get the New Orleans Jazz Festival going. I think he helped those guys that got that started.
They were already going, but they were kind of like falling over themselves. Their first few years weren't very successful. I believe that George got involved with them in 1969. You'd have to look that up, but I think it was 1969 where he really started to, you know, get involved in that festival and professionalized it. And he's 94 now, and he doesn't, he's not too active. He still goes to work, and he's still running, you know, festival productions. But he's farmed out. I mean, like Christian McBride is the artistic director at Newport. I mean, he's farmed out most of the work, but he is still there. He tools around on his golf cart, and he makes sure that, you know, the trash is getting picked up.
Uh-huh.
And the places that need to have, you know, cold water have it available for the people.
Uh-huh.
So he's still, you know, he's still keeping his eye on it. And he has stopped playing. One thing you missed is the Newport Jazz All-Stars. He was touring the world with the Newport Jazz All-Stars, his band. He's a piano player and a quite good one. And he kept playing with the All-Stars until he was 89. And then he stopped. And he didn't stop because he couldn't play anymore. He stopped because he couldn't hear anymore.
Uh-huh.
He said, it's not fair to the other musicians on the bandstand that I can't hear them that well. Mm. So if you want him to play solo piano, he'll play for you all night, but he doesn't play with bands anymore because his ears are bad.
Gotcha.
I think that's pretty good.
Pretty good indeed. Is he a native son of Boston? Do you know?
He comes from the suburb called Newton, which is just to the west. It was also home to Ralph Burns and Serge Chaloff and Fred Taylor, the guy from the Scholars Jazz Club and the Jazz Workshop, and various other people. Raz Kran, who was in the International Sweethearts of Rhythm back in the war years. A lot of people have come from Newton. It's an interesting, it's a suburb with 80,000 people in it. It's not like it's a small town. But he's from Newton. And Nat Hentoff was a Bostonian. And George Frazier was the other great writer that came from here in those early years. Another Bostonian.
Now, I'm looking at your blog, and you get really into depth on individual musicians. I guess the most recent thing that you posted is about a guy named Bob Wilbur.
Bob Wilbur.
And Wilbur Mania. Yep. So these articles are your chance to sort of lay out on specific artists and go into greater depth maybe than appears in the book or new research.
It's kind of whatever strikes my fancy. I haven't been blogging as regularly. You know, when I started the blog in 2013, I was going great guns. I was just writing something every other day. But now it's really very infrequent. And when I do write, they tend to be long pieces, you know, 1,200 word, 1,500 word pieces. And I'm tending to I only write about stories that you're not going to find anyplace else. There's an unfortunate thing going on that if a famous personage passes away, it seems like there's 422 people on the internet that want to write about him or her, and they pretty much say the same stuff. So I really dig, and, you know, I really dug hard for the Bob Wilbur stuff because he spent about 4 years living in Boston. He's from your neck of the woods. He's from Scarsdale originally.
Okay.
And he did spend some time here in Boston. He was a Sidney Bechet disciple. And he spent some time in Boston as the head guy at a place called the Savoy and that whole business with Wilbur Mania. He had a fan club here, and they had parades for him, and it was crazy. It was nuts. But that's a story that not very many people know. Dan Morgenstern told me that this book is great because there's just stuff here that just isn't any place else. And that's what happens if you go to the newspapers and turn every page. You're going to find the stuff that's been forgotten.
And I'm looking, I just picked one month at random of February 2013, and you've got a notice about Ain't Misbehavin', the Fats Waller review,
yep,
coming to Boston.
And great jazz band for that. Yeah,
yeah, Herb Pomeroy and Andy McGee and Dick Johnson, Kenny Wenzel,
yep.
Rudy Collins on drums. Then you have a sort of a flashback to 1937, city bureaucrats hit, quote, lawless nightclubs, unquote.
Oh, yeah. I think that's when they were shutting down Eddie Levine's nightclub, because Eddie Levine was a bootlegger, and he had a very hard time when things went legit. He had a very hard time with the concept of closing time. It just wasn't something that came naturally to him.
Uh-huh.
And so he just couldn't stop pouring. As long as there were people who wanted to buy a drink, he'd sell them a drink and the band would keep playing and the city would come in and they'd shut him down and whatnot. And this went on and on. They finally just had to revoke his license and kick him out. He just couldn't get used to the idea of a closing time, right? You know, you close when the last person leaves, right? So that's, I think, what was going on back in that date in 1937.
And then you have a feature on a very interesting fellow. Never heard of him before. He doubled on violin and saxophone, Ray Perry.
Oh, a genius. A brilliant guy. A really brilliant guy. Yeah. And you know about Flam Stewart and the way that Flam Stewart would bow his bass and he'd hum an octave above, but he'd follow the same notes, so he'd be basically playing a duet with himself. He'd
mm-hmm.
be doing
sure.
the vocal. Yeah, Ray Perry started doing that. Ray Perry was Flam Stewart played with Ray Perry at Levine's Club, come to think of it. And he picked up that habit from Ray, but Ray Perry was an amazing guy. His big claim to fame was his time with Lionel Hampton, and there is a tune that Lionel Hampton has that you can find on YouTube called Fiddle Dee Dee, which will blow your mind with Ray Perry's violin abilities. He was up there with Eddie South and Stuff Smith.
Oh,
he died very young. He died in 1950, and he was about 35 years old with some horrible disease or other. But he was a real mainstay on the Boston scene. He had two brothers who were also jazz musicians.
Well, I'm going to look him up. I used to play a little violin myself, and then, and this is all 1 month's worth of blog posts, February 24th, 1960, Lewis and Duke, one night only at the Pioneer Club. Oh, my God.
Pioneer Club. Yeah, that was a story. That one took some real digging. The Pioneer Club was an after-hours club, and it was the one where the entertainers used to like to go. And there were other after-hours clubs for other kinds of people, but the entertainers all used to go to the Pioneer. And when the musicians' gigs were over, they'd all just go there and hang out and relax. Well, they had a little second floor with a piano and basically nothing else, just a piano. And one night, Duke Ellington had a concert in the ballroom at the Hotel Bradford, and Louis Armstrong was just south of town, one of the beach towns on the South Shore. And they kind of met they didn't plan it. They just bumped into each other at the Pioneer Club at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they just started to play. Louis sang and Duke played all night long. And you always knew when it was time to leave. The African-American musicians that had day jobs liked to work at the post office because, you know, the money was steady and you could always get a day off if you needed one for a gig. And so the African-American postmen would all show up for coffee at about 5:30 in the morning on their way to work. And that was the sign that it was getting to be time to close the Pioneer Club down for the night. But there are many stories of, you know, the Billie Holidays of the world and, you know, the Louis Armstrongs of the world and half a Count Basie's band and whatnot all playing at the Pioneer Club after hours. It was a private club. It was against the law to be doing what they were doing. But, hey, you know, you can fix that. You can always take care of that.
You have a line in your article that the club was by no means a secret, but most Boston was completely unaware of its existence, which was just fine with the ownership.
Absolutely. Well, and it was owned by a fairly influential guy in the black community. And it was, I don't know what the correct word is. It's not a bribe, but they were allowed to operate. They were reliably contributing votes to the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party, which was controlling City Hall at the time, was all just, they were happy with the idea. So they just let the place go, and it was a big story, and it kept going. Society finally, in the Boston area, society finally started to turn against that kind of after hours, that kind of nightlife. It just sort of ran its course. And those clubs all started to close approximately 1970. You know, the times were different, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the Pioneer actually had to go legitimate for a little bit in 1972, but that was no fun. So they closed down, I think, 1973, and then the building was raised for some urban development project or other in 1974. Now the street that it was on doesn't even exist on the map. It was on Westfield Street, and that's gone. It's off the map. The building on it now.
I know that there was a circuit for African-American musicians. Every city had a hotel, often with a ballroom attached, where African-American musicians felt comfortable. It was maybe in the South, it might have been the only hotel they could stay in. Maybe that problem wasn't so acute in Boston.
Oh, sure it was.
It was. Same problem, huh? Wow.
Yeah. Not the same problem, but it was still a problem. It depended on where you were. The Back Bay, which is, you know, the nicer part of downtown, quote unquote, all the Back Bay hotels were pretty much closed to African-American guests. There was only one exception, which was the Bostonian, which is a big hotel on Boylston Street in the Back Bay. And they let anybody in. And that was a place where, you know, Dizzy liked to stay there, and Duke liked to stay there, and various, you know, it was a nice place, a nice hotel. But mostly what black musicians were doing was they were staying in rooming houses in the black neighborhoods in town. Pretty much the same story. Boston had a real problem with, you know, racial situations and so forth, especially in the 70s when, you know, the busing thing happened, busing integrating the schools. But the struggles, I do remember talking to some of the musicians about how they were very proud of the fact that they were in the first black jazz trio to play in some of these Back Bay hotels where they had never had black entertainers before. And the color line, it was interesting talking to these people about watching the color lines going down. It started in the late 40s and it continued, you know, it took a long time before the color line was completely down in all the clubs. George Ween, when I interviewed George, one of the times I talked to George, he talked about that a lot. He said there were always hotels in poorer parts of town or in less I would like to say ritzy, but that's not quite right, but the less well-to-do. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
There were already hotels that weren't in that neighborhood where black musicians could always stay down in the theater district and whatnot. Those hotels were open. So it was easier here than it was in a lot of places. But by no means was, you know, Jim Crow not present.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So everyone can get a good flavor of Richard's writing by going to troystreet.com. And
yep.
there's a lot of information there and really a lot of articles. And I just gave you a small sampling of 1 month's production. That's not even a whole month. And then there's the book, The Boston Chronicles, Part 1, I guess. And then Boston Chronicles Part 2 is in the works.
Jazz Chronicles Part 2 is in the works, and stay tuned.
I never ask an author when the book will come out, but if you're inclined to let us know when it is ready, do let us know, and I'll make sure everybody knows that it's available when it's ready.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Richard Vacca, author of the Boston Jazz Chronicles, also the proprietor of TroyStreet.com. I think it's pretty clear that when it comes to jazz, especially in Boston, Richard's the guy to go to. I've learned a tremendous amount. I can't wait to get back to Boston. Suddenly, all these fragmentary, you know, I knew Berklee existed. I knew Jackie Byard was at a New England Conservatory. I knew that there were some good clubs in Boston historically, but now I'm starting to really get a much better picture of the scene. And the great news is that the scene is alive and well, and there's plenty for the jazz fan to do. So if you're on a tour of the United States and you're wondering where to go and you're intimidated by the prices in New York City and the complexity of getting there, Boston sounds to me like an absolutely great place for a jazz fan to land and spend a couple of days or a week or so. Especially your tip about going to the colleges. That's a big one. That's where you could encounter some magic, I bet.
Yep. And like I say, right this particular week, you won't find anything going on at the schools because they're out of session right now.
Gotcha.
But during the school year and even during the summer, you'll find things. And Berklee does have a performance center where they bring in name bands as a concert hall. So, you know, but the schools have just lots and lots of stuff going on.
And I imagine you mentioned Boston functioning kind of as a farm team for the Big Apple. I imagine for a young jazz musician that's wanting to get, you know, develop themselves, Boston is not a bad place to spend time doing that.
That's right. But I think I can't speak for all of the young musicians because obviously I couldn't possibly know them all. But I really think that they're considering their college town as a way station. And some stay, but not very many. I mean, mostly you're getting your things together here and then you're going off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the way it's been. And, you know, the farm team reference was really for a little bit of an earlier time. That kind of jazz world doesn't really exist anymore. But there was a time where places like Boston and Detroit and Pittsburgh and Toledo were just basically farm teams. Just, you know, when you think you got yourself together, you go to New York. That's the way it was.
Gotcha. Oh, you know, I want to throw one that just popped into my mind. The late, great Emily Rimler.
She was Berklee maybe pretty close to the same time all those other guys were.
Yeah, and she was fantastic. I used to see her play at, I forget the exact name of the club, but it had Grand in the name down in Soho. And yeah, she was a product of Berklee as well. Well, Richard, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for enlightening us all about Boston. I bet you are going to this call is going to stimulate a lot of visits to Boston. Remember, you can find out and keep up with everything that Richard is doing at TroyStreet.com. The blog's fantastic. Definitely start there. And I hear sometimes you give tours of music tours of Boston. Is that right?
I do. I have this one-person conglomerate going for the nightlife thing. I do nightlife walks. They're about 90 minutes. I have three different ones, and we walk through the neighborhoods, through the entertainment districts. And it's not just jazz, because you can't just sell a jazz tour. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you try to do that as a pure thing, you're just not going to get enough people. But I call them nightlife walks, and you mix in theater, and you mix in, you know, soul music and R&B music, and, you know, you got some jazz, and you got some gangsters, and you got some politicians behaving badly, and you got stuff that everybody likes. And I just package those things up and take people out for a 90-minute walk. And it's always a lot of fun. It's
great.
Different every time.
Great. And people can contact you through TroyStreet.com?
Yeah, they can find the website and they can send an email and I will respond to them. Yeah.
Great, great. So that'll add another dimension to a visit to Boston. Well, again,
you'll have to do one the next time.
Oh, I will. I want to. I love stuff like this. Before we started the recording, Richard and I were talking about just jazz scenes in other cities, and it's an interest apparently of both of us.
Oh yes, you know, yes.
You know, we know there's great jazz everywhere. It's not just limited to New York or New Orleans or Chicago. And so we're slowly filling in the blanks of all the different cities, and I think we got Boston covered pretty well. Now, you probably are aware of this, but somewhere on my site, I did an interview with a guy who's expert on the Tokyo jazz scene, and it sounds epic. It sounds huge. And they even – are you aware of this? It's just – because not many people are, but they have – there are many, many, many little micro – you can't even call them clubs. They're more like jazz shrines. And they're tiny and they're in weird places. Sometimes they're on the second floor. They may only have seating for 5 people. And the owner will have the best record collection you've ever seen in your life and handmade speakers. And, you know, jazz lovers will just come and have a coffee and request, you know, a particular piece of vinyl. And there's apparently scores of these things in Tokyo. So this,
I'm not surprised. They're devotees there. They love their jazz. They really love their jazz.
Well,
they're very serious.
They have good taste, and I'm going to make sure his name's Richard Catchpole, and I'm going to make sure he knows about this interview so he can spread the word in Tokyo, because they are such great fans and great devotees of the music, great students of the music. I hope they're aware. We'll help make them aware that Boston should be on their agenda when they do their travels. Well, thank you, Richard. Again, the book is Boston Jazz Chronicles, the website TroyStreet.com, all things jazz in Boston. And thank you for the time, and hope to see you in the flesh someday.
I truly enjoyed it, and thanks very much for the opportunity.
Great. Well, thank you for your time, and I am coming back to Boston.
I'll be waiting. All right.
All right.
You take care.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.